The plan for this lecture and the last lecture, which is on Thursday, is to do the Unruh effect today and the Hawking effect, that is to say Hawking radiation, on Thursday. You may wonder, why do we do the Unruh effect again? Didn't we do this early on, lecture 8? Yes, we did it, but today we will do it differently. In lecture 8, we did it this way, that we took Unruh de Witt detectors, which is to say an atom or an ion or some molecule which has two dedicated energy levels that we monitor, and we accelerate that, and then we find that by studying the interaction between the Unruh de Witt detector, let's say an atom, and the quantum field, we find that the accelerated atom is experiencing excitation the same way as if it was exposed to a heat bath, under the assumption that the acceleration is uniform. Today we will rederive that result, namely that under uniform acceleration, an observer will see an environment that is thermal. The observer will see that a quantum field is in a thermal state, where the temperature is proportional to the acceleration. Why would we do this today? We do it because the methods that we use for the Unruh effect are extremely similar to those that we will then use for the Hawking effect. And I shouldn't be surprised, because the two effects are related by the equivalence principle. Locally, you can't distinguish whether you're accelerated or exposed to gravity. The methods that we will develop today are actually just an application of what we've done before, but with an extra twist. So far, we found that these Bogolyubov alpha and beta coefficients do non-trivial things, but they don't mix. What I mean by that is that we had alpha and beta coefficients, Bogolyubov alpha and beta coefficients, for each co-moving mode separately. But the alpha and beta coefficients of one mode were not interfering with the others. In other words, we could express the A and A dagger operator of a mode in terms of the A tilde and A tilde dagger operators of the same mode later on. But no other modes played into this. Generically, though, the Bogolyubov transformations can relate all of the A and A daggers of one system, of one quantization, to all of the A and A daggers of the other one. And that's what we get for the Unruh effect and also for the Hawking effect. So the Bogolyubov transformations are going to be more non-trivial. Also, remember, just to remind you of where to pay attention to, the Bogolyubov alpha coefficients we found on general grounds never do much. They don't change the vacuum state. They don't create particles. Bogolyubov alpha coefficients is what you get when you do something harmless, like a rotation, a translation, a Lorentz transformation. That will always take the vacuum to a vacuum, will always take the five-particle state to a five-particle state. Even if the direction of the momentum changes, doesn't make new particles. The Bogolyubov beta coefficients are the interesting ones because they describe particle creation and changes in quantum fluctuations and so on. All right, so today we do the Unruh effect from the perspective of Bogolyubov transformations. And we take that as a preparation then for the Hawking effect on Thursday. You will study the Unruh effect in 1 plus 1 dimensions because of a technical simplification that occurs in 1 plus 1 dimensions, not because it's fundamentally necessary. It just makes the calculations easier because we have more conformal symmetry in 1 plus 1 dimensions than we would have in 3 plus 1. I will point out at the relevant places where things would be more complicated if we did it in 3 plus 1 dimensions. OK, so we look at the Unruh effect in 1 plus 1 dimensions. The metric in inertial Cartesian coordinates is given by a 2 by 2 matrix, because we just have two dimensions here. In principle, by the way, we could do, let me just mention it right now, we could do everything here except for one place, everything we could do in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And in that one place, we could also do it, but it would be more messy. So in 1 plus 1 dimensions, if we use inertial Cartesian coordinates, the metric takes the usual form. We use this signature today. And then Let's consider an observer's trajectory. Let's call it x alpha of tau. And we will not consider now an atom that follows this trajectory. That's what we did in lecture 8. Instead, we will consider an entire coordinate system where the origin is defined by that trajectory. So we will define a coordinate system that has its origin always on that trajectory there. It's an accelerated coordinate system. And that allows us to describe not only what one atom experiences that's being accelerated, but anything that's accelerated with the atom that is sitting at rest in that accelerated coordinate system would experience the same. We use as the parameter for the trajectory the proper time of an observer who sits there or who travels on this trajectory. Remember, the Unruh effect is to claim that something that's accelerated, like an ice cube, would melt. Okay, so let's consider the velocity and the acceleration and the properties of these quantities relativistically. Just a quick review of something that you've probably seen before. So let's look at the four velocity. If this is the trajectory, the four velocity is defined by differentiating every one of the components of this four vector. In our special case, it's a two vector, but in principle, it's a four vector. We just differentiate with respect to the proper time tau. And the claim is that if tau is the proper time, then the length of this, the invariant length of this velocity vector is always one. No matter what, the velocity vector is always one. Now, what would be the intuition for this? Can't we sometimes be fast and sometimes slow? We can. But relativistically speaking, we are always traveling at the same speed. It's four-dimensionally, right? If we are sitting still, we're just traveling only in time. If we're moving, we're traveling in time and space. But the overall length is always one. The overall length of the velocity vector is always one. So standing still in 4D is not standing still. It's moving just in time at full speed. So let's prove this. At any point in time, any proper time, we can go into the rest frame of our traveler. And in the rest frame, we have the coordinates, the trajectory. In the rest frame coordinates x bar, the coordinates of the traveler in 1 plus 1 dimensions are just tau and 0. The traveler is only traveling in time, not in space. The derivative of that with respect to the proper time is therefore 1, 0. And the length of that vector, the invariant length of it, is 1, of course. And since this is a scalar, it is coordinate system independent. So we would have obtained the same number no matter what coordinate system we had used to calculate it. Now let's look at the acceleration. The acceleration vector is obtained by, again, covariantly, again, differentiating the velocity vector with respect to the proper time. Now, because of that equation, we can immediately conclude that the velocity vector and the acceleration vector are covariantly orthogonal to each other. So if you contract the x double dot with the x dot, then that is 0. So not only are we always moving full speed, either only in time or in time and space, but also the acceleration that we have on whatever trajectory. Remember, this is for all trajectories, not just uniformly accelerated ones. For all trajectories, the acceleration is, if we have, is always orthogonal to our velocity. How do we see that? Well, let's just take our result here, which is that the length of the velocity vector is 1. And differentiate that with respect to the proper time. So that's 0, of course, because 1 is constant. But this is twice x double dot x contracted. And so therefore, these two are covariantly orthogonal. I'm saying covariantly orthogonal because the metric here is the eta mu nu metric. It's not the Euclidean metric. It's the covariant metric. So what we have is, because of that, we have that since we can go into the rest frame of the observer at any point in proper time that we want, we have that in that rest frame, we have that the velocity is 1, 0. But since that vector is orthogonal to the acceleration vector has to have only non-zero components here, cannot be non-zero there. And so what we have then is that there is an a of t here, which is the second derivative of the space variable with respect to the proper time. And so therefore, in every reference frame, we have that quantity. Because you see, the length is a scalar. The length of the acceleration vector is a scalar. And it's this one. It would have been the same number, no matter in which coordinate system we calculate. OK, so that's some generalities. Now let's look at the case of uniform acceleration. What do we even mean by uniform acceleration? Well, what we mean is that this acceleration number, remember, we are working only with 1 plus 1 dimensions, so there's only one space dimension. Therefore, the acceleration is described by one number. Let's call it a. And let's say that this a is constant, doesn't depend on the proper time. That's what you would have if you have a spaceship and it burns the same amount of fuel per second, no matter how fast it's traveling. Of course, that's a bit difficult because it must have a fuel tank too. But let's assume that that's much larger than, so that it doesn't matter, so we can keep the mass the same. So if you always apply the same propulsion, then, and assuming the same mass, then that you would get uniform acceleration. So it's uniform acceleration from the point of view of the traveler. The traveler always gets the same, is pressed to the floor of the spacecraft with the same force. That's what uniform acceleration means. And here now we have a uniform acceleration trajectory. Obviously, there are many uniform acceleration trajectories, and this is one of them. So the time and the space coordinate as a function of the proper time of the traveler, so t of tau and x of tau, are given by this expression here. T of tau is the Cartesian coordinate Minkowski space time, and x of tau is the Cartesian coordinates Minkowski space coordinate. They're given by the hyperbolic sine and the hyperbolic cosine. And the acceleration shows up here. Now remember, in case you don't remember, because these come up all the time, we have that the hyperbolic sine of x is 1 half e x minus e minus x. And then the hyperbolic cosine of x is 1 half, and then with the plus. And from that, we have that this, right? It's slightly different from the sine and cosine. And that's what we will use. So here we have this trajectory. And it's claimed to be a trajectory of uniform acceleration. Let's check. What's the velocity vector? Well, we differentiate the hyperbolic sine, and we get the hyperbolic cosine, right? Because this minus sign comes down, and we get the hyperbolic cosine. And similarly, the hyperbolic cosine directly becomes the hyperbolic sine, because if you differentiate this guy, you just get a minus sign there. There's no messy stuff with imaginary units in the hyperbolic sines and cosines. So these 1 over a prefactors go away because of the chain rule with the a. So that's the velocity vector. And then using that the sine squared minus the cosine squared is 1, we have that. Well, there we have to look up the signature of the metric. But in any case, what you get is that you have this squared minus that squared equal to 1. And now we can also calculate, OK, this tells us, the fact that this length is 1 tells us that not only is it a trajectory, it also tells us that the parameter in here is the proper time. Because we needed, in order to derive this, we used that it was the proper time. We used it when we said that we go into the rest frame. Rest frame means that the time coordinate is the proper time. So we just identified that this is a trajectory where tau is the proper time. Now let's check that it's actually a uniformly accelerated trajectory. For that, we differentiate the velocity vector yet again. Now we get another factor of a. Here we go. And then the length of that acceleration vector is minus a squared. I hope I didn't mix up that minus sign. Anyway, so it's minus a squared. It's a constant. It doesn't depend on tau. That's the important part. So what that means is that it's a uniformly accelerated trajectory. Now, that trajectory here can be drawn. And if we want to draw it, we can use the fact that as is easily checked, if you take the time coordinate and square it, and you take the space coordinate and square it. Oh, apparently it's a minus here, right? Then you get that this is minus 1 over a squared, right? Because the sin squared minus the cosine squared is minus 1. And that equation tells us that this trajectory is a hyperbola. It's this hyperbola, where here the space coordinate is drawn, and this is the time coordinate. So what this means is that this trajectory comes in from far away, x1 very large. It comes in from here. And then, you know, time is going this way. So as time passes, this trajectory comes in from large x1 towards the origin in space. At the same time, it's moving forward in time, so it goes like that. And then at time t equal to 0, this traveler has its closest, the closest distance to the origin of the coordinate system. And then the traveler is at speed 0, right? Because at this point, the traveler is traveling only in time, not in space anymore. So here, the traveler is at velocity 0, and then picks up speed again. So here is where the traveler is decelerating, and then here the observer is, or the traveler is accelerating again. And the whole thing is a uniform acceleration. This curve is asymptotic to that line of 45 degrees, and that curve is asymptotic to this line of 45 degrees. We can see from this, as I think we briefly discussed in lecture 8 on the Unruh effect, we have that this observer here, anybody who travels that trajectory forever, I mean since forever and forever, any such observer actually has a past and a future horizon. And that's because whatever that observer does will propagate in the forward light cone. So for example, here, the observer might send light or matter. Whatever it is, this stuff will propagate within the forward light cone. So it will not be able to travel here. It can only travel here. Anything above that line is what our observer can send signals to. On the other hand, everything that's above that line cannot signal to the observer, right? Because the forward light cone goes like this. So anything that's emitted here or there cannot travel at such a shallow angle, because that would be superluminal, to reach the observer. So the observer has a past and a future horizon. And they are defined by the curves x0 plus or minus x1. In other words, these curves are x0 plus x1 equal to 0 and x0 minus x1 equal to 0. These curves, these variables, x0 plus x1 and x0 minus x1, will be useful. Namely, to define the so-called light cone coordinates. So remember, we are still in an inertial coordinate system. We are describing everything from the perspective of somebody who is not accelerated. We're just using Minkowski space, Cartesian coordinates, and we describe this fancy accelerated trajectory. And we will continue to do that for another few minutes. But now we will change coordinates to other inertial coordinates, namely the so-called light cone coordinates. Instead of using x0 and x1, we will find it useful later on. It's not obvious why it would be useful now. Now it's just a complication that looks unnecessary. But later we will see that it's actually a very useful choice of coordinate system, namely when it comes to wave equations, when we go to quantum fields and look for solutions to the equation of motion. Then it will become very useful. So for now, we will introduce this coordinate system. Only later it will become clear how exactly it will simplify the calculations. So the new coordinates we will call u and v, and they are defined to be x0 minus x1 and x0 plus x1. You can think of it as a 45-degree rotation in the xy plane, or in the xt plane. So the u and the v are the new variables. And that's the relationship between them. Obviously, that's a very simple change of coordinates, and it's easy to calculate how vectors and tensors transform, and in particular, it's easy to calculate how the metric tensor looks then. Let's do that. In the x0, x1 coordinate system, the metric is, of course, just this, the 1 minus 1 metric. But if we go to the so-called light cone coordinates, then the metric turns out to be off diagonal. It has nothing on the diagonal. It has a 1/2 and a 1/2 on the off diagonals. This has the funny effect that instead of having the line element being dx0 squared plus dxy or minus dx1 squared, now the line element is du dv. Because if you put a du dv and a du dv in here and contract that, you get a 1/2 du dv and another 1/2 du dv. So you get overall just a du dv here. And that will be instrumental later in simplifying the solution to the wave equation. You can easily check that the metric goes from this form to that form under this change of coordinates just by using that covariant indices transform in this way with the change of coordinates, Jacobi matrices. So in particular, once we have these new variables, these new so-called light cone coordinates, we can look at our fancy trajectory, the uniformly accelerated trajectory there. And this trajectory will then have a u coordinate as a function of proper time and a v coordinate as a function of proper time. The trajectory can be written as x tilde of tau. And it's a matter of a few calculations to find that the u coordinate as a function of proper time is this exponential, and the v coordinate as a function of the proper time is that exponential. Why would we get these exponentials? Well, because you know, if you add the x0 and the x1, and each one of them is a sine, a hyperbolic sine or a hyperbolic cosine, then you have this plus that or this minus that. And therefore, you get either the one or the other exponential canceling and the other one surviving. So now, if we put together what we have up here and the new coordinates, we can plot again what the trajectory looks like. Well, in the UV coordinate system, you can't really say that this is space and that's time anymore because both of them contain both. But if you want to see actually how this works, well, the lines of constant time were in the above coordinate system. They went like this. You know, constant time is like these lines. They are constant time. And this was constant space like that. Well, now it's rotated 45 degrees. Lines of constant time go like this, right? And lines of constant space go like that. And then our trajectory happens to be this one. We could have put in our trajectory a minus sign in front of the x coordinate, and then, I mean, or in front of the time coordinate, we could have that sit in this, that, or that quadrant. But what's important is that up here, we had horizons like this and like that. Now, 45 degrees rotated, the horizons are this and that. You see, the light cone is now no longer like this. The light cone is like that now. So far, we have studied a trajectory within two coordinate systems. We looked at this uniformly accelerated trajectory from the Cartesian coordinates in Minkowski space and from the light cone coordinates in Minkowski space. But now, let's design a special coordinate system that travels with the accelerated observer, a permanent rest frame for the accelerated observer. Now, there are a gazillion coordinate systems that would do that. Because if all we want is a coordinate system in which the accelerated observer is always at rest, well, then the only thing we know about that coordinate system is where its origin is. But what about the rest of the coordinate system? How do we fix that? So we have a lot of choice here. We can make demands on that coordinate system. We can say, yes, we want a coordinate system in which the accelerated trajectory is actually always sitting at the origin, but we can actually require more of the coordinate system. Let's figure out what might be a good choice of what we might require as well in order to fix what coordinate system we work with. So we want a coordinate system, let's call these new coordinates x mu, so x0 and x1, such that the traveler's trajectory is tau comma 0, meaning the traveler is always at the origin and traveling forward only in time. So that's what it means to say that in the new coordinate system, our trajectory is at the origin. But this fixes the new coordinates only where the trajectory actually is. How shall we continue the new coordinate system elsewhere? Well, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, we can always require that we can always find a coordinate system such that the light cones are still at 45 degrees, even for a uniformly accelerated coordinate system. Those who took my course last term, maybe remember how that works. Whenever you have a space-time that's only two-dimensional, you can do that. You can always write your metric in the form of the Minkowski metric with a prefactor, with a scalar prefactor. You can always do that. In fact, it's even a little bit more general. You can also do that in any number of dimensions, except there's a caveat, right? Because if that was possible in any number of dimensions without any restrictions, then GR would be so much easier, because there would only be 1 degree of freedom. It's always the Minkowski metric with just a scalar function in front. No, it only works in higher dimensions if you pick 2 dimensions out of those many dimensions. If you pick 1 time and 1 space dimension, then you can always do that. You can always write your metric as on that 2-dimensional submanifold, you can do that. You can write it in this way that it's the Minkowski metric with the prefactor. That fact is the reason why we can use Penrose diagrams. We pick like a 3 plus 1 dimensional black hole space-time or something like this, and then we neglect the angles. So we only deal with the time and the radius. Bang, we have 2 dimensions, and we can use the fact that everything can be written as Minkowski space with Minkowski space form metric with a scalar prefactor, which means we can rewrite that space-time in a way such that all light cones are still at 45 degrees. That's what that shape of the metric means. They're all at 45 degrees up to that scale factor, but we can just absorb all of that in that scale factor. And that's what we do. We take entire Minkowski space, we take cosmological solutions, we take black hole solutions, we pick two dimensions, one time, one space dimension, and then we can use this prefactor here to shrink even infinity down to a finite size, and we get a Penrose diagram. Okay, but here, it's not for the purpose of drawing Penrose diagrams. Here, we use this fact to require of our to-be-determined coordinate system, which is supposed to be a rest frame for our traveler, we want this coordinate system to be such that, indeed, we have that the metric takes this form. Because that means that our trajectory is at the origin of a coordinate system in which the accelerated observer is always at the origin. And in this accelerated coordinate system, still light travels at 45 degrees. If you visualize it, it always travels at 45 degrees. And that seems like a meaningful way to extend the definition of our coordinate system from just saying, well, it ought to be a rest frame, to, yeah, it ought to be a rest frame such that the metric in that rest frame takes the form of the Minkowski metric, possibly up to a prefactor here. And here's the proposition for how we can achieve this. What we need is a new coordinate system in which, of coordinates x0 and x1, in which the accelerated trajectory that we work with takes that shape. And in this new coordinate system, if you transform the metric from above into the new coordinate system, the metric should be something, something times that, something scalar times that. And here is the claimed coordinate change of coordinates that does it. Here we are expressing the new coordinates, the xi coordinates, in terms of the old coordinates, the x0 and the x1 coordinates. So given the new coordinates x0, x1, what point are they supposed to correspond to in terms of the old coordinates, x0 and x1? Well, these, calculated in this way. And what you can see right away is that if you choose, for example, in this coordinate system, the xi0, xi1 coordinate system, if you consider all those points where xi1 is 0, that is to say, you're considering the origin of that coordinate system, because x1 is 0, the origin of this coordinate system over time, and you ask, what points does this correspond to in the old coordinate system? Well, then you have e to the power 0 here, e to the power 0 there. So that's 1, that's 1. And this and that is the trajectory of our accelerated observer. Right? The trajectory of the accelerated observer is, by definition, where is it? Here, right? 1 over a hyperbolic sine, 1 over a hyperbolic cosine, but without any exponential in here. And down here, you see 1 over a exponent, hyperbolic sine, 1 over a hyperbolic cosine. So at the origin, the origin's trajectory is the trajectory of the accelerated observer, but we have extra stuff here. And what we can show, and that's a bit of a calculation, of course, you just have to calculate the Jacobi matrix. You can calculate what happens to the metric. How does the metric look in this new coordinate system, this uniformly accelerated coordinate system, and this is how it comes out. As required, it's the Minkowski space metric, form metric, multiplied now with this prefactor function. Okay. So in particular, in this new coordinate system, light cones still travel at 45 degrees. Now, why wasn't it a bit weird that I showed you the new coordinates, not in terms of the old coordinates, but the old coordinates in terms of the new ones, right? So here you can take the new coordinates and calculate what the old coordinates are for the same events, but not the other way around. Why not? Any guesses why not? Because there is no inverse. See, there is no inverse because actually the new coordinate system covers only what the accelerated observer can see. The accelerated observer has a horizon here, a horizon there. So all those events up here don't map into any xi coordinates. The xi naught and xi 1, ranging from minus infinity to plus infinity, both of them, cover only that quadrant here. It's the world that this accelerated observer and everybody who travels with him observe, just that. It's bounded by that horizon, and the coordinate system goes as far as it can go there. So all of the xi naught and xi 1 in R2, all of that maps only into that so-called Rindler wedge, where this is, again, the space coordinate, and that's the time coordinate. And if we choose xi naught, xi 1 to be 0, so the origin of the new coordinate system, then we get the trajectory of our traveler. If we chose a different xi 1 value, larger or smaller, then we would get another, we get not this hyperbola, we would get another hyperbola. And the xi 1 value determines whether it goes through some points here or some points there. But the set of all those hyperbolas together just fills this Rindler wedge exactly once. Now remember that in this Rindler coordinate system, in this coordinate system of the accelerated observer, in this xi mu coordinate system, light still travels at 45 degrees. And that will be super important and useful because it means that it won't be a headache to solve the wave equation, to solve the Klein-Gordon equation in the new coordinate system. Because we will solve the Klein-Gordon equation in Minkowski space, but also we will solve the Klein-Gordon equation and quantize it also for observers that travel uniformly and use the xi coordinate system. Now, the observers who travel in this accelerated way and use the xi coordinate system will say, and I'm guessing here, they will say, yeah, we're using this Cartesian-like coordinate system where our metric is basically the Minkowski metric, except that there's a prefactor there. But what if we also wanted the benefit of light cone coordinates? Can we use light cone coordinates being accelerated travelers? And of course you can. You simply define now the sum and the difference between those xi coordinates. So you define a u bar variable, which is the xi naught minus xi 1, and the v bar that is xi naught plus xi 1. These are the light cone coordinates, and they make just as much sense because they are just, again, a 45 degree rotation of the Minkowski type coordinates xi. So then what we have is that in this, in the xi tilde coordinate, in the xi tilde coordinate system where we have the u bar and the v bar, maybe a, you see, we just need some name for the u bar and the v bar, right? And I call them xi tilde. So remember, we have two xi coordinates, the Cartesian ones where the metric is like the Minkowski with the prefactor, and the xi tilde are the light cone accelerated coordinates, the u bar and the v bar. And for them, the metric is, of course, like the 1/2, 1/2, but it has a prefactor. And that prefactor now is just like that, but it's expressed, I mean, it's exactly that prefactor just expressed in terms of the V bar and the U bar. You see, we have the Xi1. If you solve these two equations for Xi1, then you get it's V bar minus U bar, and you plug that in here, and you get that. I mean, it's 1/2 V bar minus U bar. Okay. We have four coordinate systems now. I hope you don't mix them up. We have Cartesian inertial. We have Cartesian accelerated. We have light cone inertial and light cone accelerated. And for each one of those, we expressed what the metric is. For the inertial ones, the metric is just the Minkowski metric, either with the 1 minus 1 or with the 1/2 off diagonal. And then in the accelerated case, we have that the Cartesian accelerated have this metric. This it's always the same metric, right? It's the same space-time, so it's the same metric. But in the accelerated Cartesian coordinates, this is how the metric looks, and the same metric in the accelerated light cone coordinates looks like that. And here the invariant length squared is then up to a prefactor du bar dv bar. Now, the way we proceeded was this. We went from the Cartesian, we went from the coordinates x0, x1. We went to the u and v light cone coordinates. This is all Minkowski, and this is all inertial, right? Here's inertial. And then we said, OK, we can go from here to an accelerated coordinate system, psi naught, psi 1. So this is accelerated up here. And from there, we went to u bar, v bar by going to these light cone coordinates there. But we can also directly go from here to there. There has to be a coordinate transformation there. And that coordinate transformation I'm giving you here. So here we have the u variable. Actually, it goes from here to here, right? Because these guys only cover what the accelerated folks can see. And that's within those, within that Rindler wedge. Right? And that we can map into what observers who are inertial can see. But of course, observers who are inertial can see other things that couldn't be there. So there's only a map in this direction. And that's what it is. We find that actually the u bar, and that's a pretty thing that we should show here, the u bar maps into the u, and the v bar maps into the v. That's very convenient. So we have that the u bar maps into the u, and the v bar maps into v. That's just shortcutting. It's just calculating the result of going this way, right? We can go from here. We can go from here to there, actually. This should also be an arrow this way. That goes both ways, right? So we can travel from here to here to here to there. And that shortcut is this expression here. Now, at this point, you may wonder why the emphasis on this one rather than that one. And this will turn out later to be a very important formula. We will calculate things for so-called right movers and left movers. And we will calculate for one of the two. The other one works the same way. And what we will need is this particular expression there. So please remember that. We have a formula that relates u bar to u with this exponential behavior. So a quick summary. If we use these coordinates, the Cartesian inertial coordinates, then the metric takes this Minkowski form. Because after all, it's always Minkowski space. Nothing is curved today. And then we went to the to the inertial light cone coordinates, u and v, inertial light cone coordinates, then the metric had this off-diagonal form. Then we went to the accelerated coordinate system. In the inertial, in the Cartesian accelerated coordinate system, the metric takes this form with this prefactor here. And in the accelerated light cone coordinate system, u bar v bar, the metric takes also this off-diagonal form, but with the prefactor here. And so what we see here is that these metrics are conformally related, right? So this metric is related to that up to a conformal prefactor, and this to that up to a conformal prefactor. Now, at this point, it will pay off that we do that in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So far, we could have done all of this also in any number of dimensions. At one point, we wanted to have, when we defined our coordinate system, we said, yeah, we wanted to have just the prefactor and so on. You can still do it in 3 plus 1 dimensions, but then, for example, if it was to be a black hole or something like that, then you have to neglect the angles. You just hold them fixed, and then you have a 1 plus 1 dimensional submanifold, and for it, you can do the calculation so far as we did it. Well, today we didn't really do a black hole. You could take Minkowski space and just neglect two space dimensions, just set them to fixed values, two coordinates, like the x2 and the x3 coordinate, you could set it fixed. But now, for what we do now, it really pays that we work in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So what we see is that the metric transforms from here to here, from there to there, just with a scalar prefactor in this way, with some factor omega squared. And it turns out that when you look at the Klein-Gordon equation without a mass term and the Klein-Gordon action from which it is derived, then you find there is a surprise, which is that under conformal transformations like this, the action doesn't change and the equation of motion doesn't change. So if we work with the metric G and calculate the action for a given field phi, or we work with a rescaled metric, G bar, with a prefactor there, we get the same action there. So the action is completely invariant under this. And why would that be so? Essentially, well, not essentially, but exactly, it is because this has always two dimensions. The metric always has two indices. And what that means is that this scale factor here comes with this square of this conformal factor. That would be the case for any dimension. But the square root of the absolute value of the metric, metric's determinant, has a determinant in it. And how many terms that determinant has depends on the number of dimensions that the spacetime has. And if it has two, then that factor, that square root factor, the measure factor here that makes the whole thing covariant, that measure factor transforms with omega squared. Make it a dimension higher, it would be omega to the third. A dimension higher would be omega to the fourth. But in two dimensions, this omega squared factor from the change from g to g bar here, omega squared, is canceling exactly the 1 over omega squared that you get from the way that the metric transforms. Sorry, if I didn't spell it out, let me just mention it. If we have that the metric transforms like this, then the inverse metric transforms with the inverse here, right? So that's why we have omega to the power of minus 2. Okay, so in two dimensions, the action is actually invariant under these transformations. By the way, if you wonder where string theory came from, it came from this. Strings are 1 plus 1 dimensional objects. So they move in time, and then they have a coordinate along the string. And string theory was built on the idea, mathematically speaking, that that symmetry is very precious. It only exists in 1+1 dimension, and you can do things with quantum field theory using that tremendous symmetry that you couldn't do in any other number of dimensions. Of course, then it was found out that string theory as a theory of only strings is incomplete. And it was discovered that actually you need also P and D brains that are higher dimensional objects. But initially the motivation was that 1+1 dimensions is special, and that's what we should go for because of that symmetry, of that enormously enlarged conformal symmetry. So now let's look at the Klein-Gordon action. Here's the Klein-Gordon action. In a general arbitrary coordinate system, it always looks like this. Now, in inertial Cartesian coordinates for Minkowski space, as we work with today, the Klein-Gordon action takes this form. And if we express it in light cone coordinates, then remember that the metric is off diagonal. So we are not going to get a dx0 squared or dx1 squared term down here. I mean, it's not translating into a second u derivative and a second v derivative term. No, because the metric is off diagonal, what we get is a du phi dv phi. That's the magic of the light cone coordinates. No second derivatives in here. It's going to be super important. And then on the Rindler wedge, a uniformly accelerated observer who builds this coordinate system that we were talking about will write the Klein-Gordon equation using the xi naught and xi1 coordinates. And how will the action look? Well, it will look exactly the same as this one because of the conformal invariance. The action is the same. And if then that uniformly accelerated observer uses light cone coordinates, those u bar, v bar coordinates, then that uniformly accelerated observer will find that this is the action. Again, identical to these actions, except the uniformly accelerated observer will only describe here the evolution of the field in the Rindler wedge, whereas this describes all of Minkowski space. This conformal symmetry is very fragile. It's true in 1+1 dimensions, but even in 1+1 dimensions, this would be destroyed if we considered massive particles. And the reason is that in that argument up here, where we said, well, this, the metric with the two upper indices transforms under g going to g bar, it transforms with omega to the power minus 2, and then the square root of g factor gives us a factor of omega squared, so therefore they cancel. Now imagine if you also had a mass term here. The mass term would be of the form square root of g times mass squared phi squared. No g alpha beta. So therefore, that mass term would actually transform non-trivially. So the mass term breaks the conformal symmetry. So we work here without mass terms. And what that means is, translating it into the physics, is this. We are considering observers who are inertial and observers who are uniformly accelerated. And both are watching a massless field like the electromagnetic field. They're not watching electrons or atoms or something. We are focusing here on the massless case. The whole thing can also be done with mass, but it's more complicated.
A quick question. So yeah. In the accelerated light cone coordinates, are we able to use the u and v differentials because of that boxed relation that relates the u bar to v?
Yes. We will need to calculate the Bogoliubov transformations from the quantization of the Klein-Gordon field in an inertial observer will perform the quantization and the accelerated observer will perform the quantization. And then they describe the same quantum field, but they write it in terms of different mode functions, different A and A dagger operators. And then we will need to find how they are related, calculate the Bogoliubov transformations. And for that, since we will do that in light cone coordinates, we will need the relationship of these light cone coordinates in order to link the ANA daggers of one observer to those of the other.
I guess looking at the formula, so there's you're taking the different, you're differentiating with respect to U bar in the last line.
Oh, yes. Oh, you mean in order? Oh, yeah, okay. Yes, yes.
No bars. Like the.
Yes, yes. These are the no bars, these are the bars, yes.
Right, but the differentials like that you're integrating over. In the one case, you go from x to psi.
Yes.
This one, and but when you change from inertial to accelerator.
Oh, like that's a mistake. That's a typo. Oh. These guys need bars. Okay. Yes, I'm sorry about that. Yes, yes, they need bars. Yes. All right, so we have the action. So let's see what the equations of motions are like. Well, let's start with inertial light cone coordinates, because we will quantize the theory in light cone coordinates. And you will soon see why the light cone coordinates are really nice for that. So the equation of motion is the Euler Lagrange equation. And that's the s by d phi, which is 0 if we don't have a mass term. It's 0. And so we have d by du of the s by d by du phi, et cetera. That's the Euler Lagrange equation here. And what is it? Well, if we functionally differentiate here, this action with respect to d by du, then we get that this goes away, and we have a d phi by dv, and then we have a d by du on that, right? And that's equal to 0. And that's just du by dv, du dv phi. And if we do this derivative here, then we get the same term. We get rid of this one, we have a du phi, but then we have to do a dv on that. So in other words, this equal to 0 gives us twice this is equal to 0. So the Euler Lagrange equation, the Klein-Gordon equation for the massless field in 1 plus 1 dimension is this one. That's actually just the D'Alembert operator. That's just a regular wave operator, but in the light cone coordinates. Instead of second time derivative minus second space derivative of phi is equal to 0, we have this. And you may wonder, OK, why is this better? And now I can show you why that's better. Namely, imagine I write down a function now, phi of u and v, which is something of u. It's a solution. It's a solution, right? Because it's a function that depends only on u. Well, right? So we differentiate with respect to u, and then it's still just a function of u. We differentiate with respect to v, it's a constant 0. So any function that's a function only of u is solving the Klein-Gordon equation. Any function that's a function only of v is solving the Klein-Gordon equation. That's why the light cone coordinates are so useful in the massless case. In the massive case, not so much. But you see, light cone coordinates ought to be good when you're dealing with light, right? Because they single out the light cone, right? And so, yeah, that's how they simplify things. So what we can use is that any function of u plus any function of v solves the Klein-Gordon equation. And one can show that these are all of the solutions. All of the solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation are of that form, function of u plus function of v, where a and b are arbitrary functions. So let's see, how would we solve it? Which solutions would we normally use? Well, this is Minkowski space. We use Cartesian coordinates that we turned into light cone coordinates. What would be a usual plane wave solution, for example? Well, for example, e to the power minus I w u. It's a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Let's see what it actually is. It's e to the power minus I omega. I said omega, I said w, but it's an omega. Omega times t minus x. That's a positive frequency solution of the Klein-Gordon equation that describes a right moving particle. If you just look at how this phase rotates in the complex plane over time and in space. So we can write it in this way. That's a solution. And we recognize, of course, that this is the kind of solution that we would use as a mode function with a suitable prefactor, perhaps, right? And indeed, if we want to rewrite the usual Minkowski space quantization now in these fancy light cone coordinates, the usual solution for the quantum field theory in Minkowski space in 1 plus 1 dimension is given by this expression here. Mode function times annihilation and creation operators. You may wonder, why four? Usually we have two. And the reason is that traditionally in this business, we would integrate only from 0 to infinity. We integrate the omega from 0 to infinity. I could also write this as an integral over k naught, running from minus infinity to plus infinity. And then we would only have two terms. But we can just integrate only from 0 to infinity and then have two terms with a positive and two terms with a negative k naught. And so we get these four terms then if we insist on integrating only from 0 to infinity. That's an option that we only have in 1 plus 1 dimensions. In 3 plus 1 dimensions, one wouldn't write it in this way. But in 1 plus 1 dimensions, you know, it's like having waves in a wire, right? They can travel right, they can travel left. And so you just have this right mover, left mover business, and you can just might as well write it all in one go here. So we have all the k, the a with index k, they're the right movers. Those with the minus k momentum, they are left movers. Yeah, and we could just integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity and then neglect that. Okay. One of the reasons why it's convenient to do that is the following. We're working here with a massless case. And in the massless case, right mover and left mover is a Lorentz invariant statement. Because if a massless wave is moving to the right, then it's definitely moving to the right no matter how fast you travel. Because you cannot overtake a wave that travels at the speed of light and then look at it from ahead and see that it moves in to the left, right? If you have a fast plane, well, maybe you have a rocket. And then from you overtake it, and from your perspective, then the rocket is traveling in the opposite direction. You turn it into a left mover from a right mover. Not with massless fields. You're not going to be able to do this. It's an invariant concept. And that will allow us in a moment to focus on just, let's say, the right movers or the left movers because they don't couple to each other. They cannot be transformed into each other. So it's nice to have them separated like this, and then we can simplify the construction a little bit. And you notice that these are things that are like booby traps for students, right? Because you might read through these things in a book and you might think, okay, now we do this, now we do that, okay, it's convenient. But it's not clear why you can do this. And a lot of the tricks that we use are special, like 1 plus 1 dimension, and now the right mover and the left mover, and so on. And then if you want to do a calculation in which there is a mass, and it's in 3 plus 1 dimensions, all of these tricks are out of the window, right? So we use them here because the literature is using them. But I'd like you to always keep in mind that they're tricks. And in reality, the calculations are a bit more messy. All right, so this is the usual Klein-Gordon field in 1 plus 1 dimension, quantized the usual way, with the usual vacuum and all of that. It's the usual mode functions. We just chose to represent them in the U and V light cone variables. Now, that's the quantization that an inertial observer would pursue. And the A operators are annihilating the state that an inertial observer would call the vacuum, because this is the right mode function for that purpose. These mode functions come with A and A dagger operators that annihilate that state that we think is the vacuum state. Now, let's do a similar procedure for the Klein-Gordon equation for the accelerated frame. So an accelerated observer would say, OK, I can only see the Rindler wedge, but let me do quantization as well as I can do it. So the accelerated observer would say, I take the action in my frame. Remember, it looks exactly the same as the action in the inertial frame, because these prefactors drop out of the action because of the large conformal symmetry here. So then the accelerated observer calculates the equation of motion and obtains this. This is the Klein-Gordon equation, now just with the bars. And so the accelerated observer concludes, I can solve my Klein-Gordon equation, no problem at all. Any solution to the Klein-Gordon equation is of the form a function in u bar plus a function in v bar, where a and b are arbitrary functions. Now, remember that for that accelerated observer, we designed the coordinate system in such a way that the accelerated observer is always addressed, and from the perspective of the accelerated observer, that is to say, in their coordinate system, the light cones are still at 45 degrees. Everything looks just the same as usual. So therefore, the accelerated observer might say, what mode functions should I choose for the quantization? Maybe I should do the same thing as if I was in Minkowski space. That observer is in Minkowski space, but not inertial. So the accelerated observer might say, well, maybe I do the same thing. I use the same mode function. The accelerated observer would say, well, for example, the function e to the power minus I omega u bar, which is this, is a solution that I recognize as a mode function. So even the accelerated observer could say, OK, I solve my quantum field theory the same way that I always solve it. And here's the solution, exactly the same way calculated as in Minkowski space. After all, the equations are the same. The accelerated observer works with the same action. Right? It looks exactly the same. The form is the same. The canonical commutation relations are the same. The field is the same. So then the only thing that changes is that that observer uses the barred variables here, which describe only one quadrant of Minkowski space. And there are horizons around that. So in principle, this is the same formula as this one there, except these are the light cone coordinates of the accelerated coordinate system. So then what do we have? We have that for the inertial observer, the vacuum state is the state that is annihilated by those operators here. So the AK operators acting on the Minkowski space vacuum give us zero. Now, for the accelerated observer, these operators, these annihilation operators, B, BK, and B minus K, annihilate what the accelerated observer would call their vacuum state, their no particle state. Now, we will assume, of course, that the physics determines what the state of the field is. And we know what the vacuum state is in Minkowski space. It's that. It's the 0m. It's the vacuum state as determined by the inertial observer. So it's that state that's annihilated by those A operators. That's the state that the quantum field is actually in. So we assume that psi in, the ingoing state here, is 0 Minkowski space. Now, if you have a cube of ice that's sitting there in Minkowski space, empty Minkowski space in the vacuum, well, then it's no longer the vacuum. But will it melt? No. It's zero temperature, right? So it will not melt. But if you accelerate it, then for that accelerated cube of ice, this is the appropriate calculation here. And anybody who's riding on that cube of ice might ask, well, will the ice melt under me or not? And that boils to the boils down to the question, if I look at the modes that I'm exposed to, that I'm interacting with, the modes of that quantum field here, which this stands in for, let's say, the electromagnetic field, will I find that that field is in the ground state or in an excited state? So that boils down to calculating how these two representations of the same quantum field are related. So an inertial observer would say, well, the quantum field is clearly this, because that's how we always quantize the quantum field in Minkowski space. We know the mode functions and all that. That's just the usual. On the other hand, the accelerated observer would say, well, what do you mean? I work with the same equations as you do. I write down the same thing here. And for me, the no particle state is the state that's annihilated by those Bs. But since it's the same field that both observers are exposed to, this must be the same as that. So there must be a relationship between the A and the B. There must be a Bogoliubov transformation that relates them. At this point, we use the fact, as we anticipated a bit earlier, that left and right movers don't mix, because you can't overtake light. A right mover is a right mover. So we will focus on just, let's say, the right movers. And then what we can say is that the right movers, B and B daggers, I mean here the B and B dagger of the right movers, must be some linear combination of the A and A dagger right movers of the inertial observer. So here we have an integration. We have a k, and from the k we calculate what the omega is, the energy. And I use here the same variable omega as over there, but maybe we should be a bit more careful with that. And so for the accelerated observer, let's call this capital omega, and for the inertial ones, little omega. I should have been consistent with this here already. So we make the ansatz that the B operators with index omega, remember the K and the omega are in one-to-one correspondence, because in principle, the K runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. And the omega is the absolute value of K. We only integrate from 0 to infinity, but that's why we have the K and the minus K terms. And the minus K terms we neglect now, because they would be a different independent calculation for just the left movers. All right, so the B depend on omega values, positive omega values. Let's call them capital omega. And in principle, there could be a linear combination of all of the annihilation and creation operators of the inertial observer. So that's why the integral here. And why would we expect that that can happen? Well, it's because if you are a traveler and you listen to a whistle that has that is monochromatic, then it will sound like a chirp to you. Because while you listen to the sound, your speed is changing. So you get a changing Doppler effect. And that's why we should expect that we get a Bogoliubov transformation here, where the alpha and beta coefficients are relating not only B of 3.7 to A of 3.7, but this B of 3.7 is related to all of those. All frequencies of the A, all wavelengths of the A, contribute to one wavelength of B. Because if you do the Fourier transform of a chirp, You get all sorts of frequencies in there. Now we know that these Bogoliubov alpha and Bogoliubov beta coefficient functions, or if you put an infrared cutoff, it would be coefficient matrices, cannot be completely arbitrary. Because if the A and A dagger obey the canonical commutation relations, and the B and B dagger are supposed to also obey them, then these coefficient matrices, coefficient functions, must obey a certain condition, which boils down to the Wronskian condition. And I leave it to you as a little exercise to just plug that in. Just plug this right-hand side into the canonical commutation relations for the B and B dagger, and you will find that you obtain this condition here on the alpha and beta matrices. So the alpha and beta matrices have to obey this. They're not completely free. But we need to know what exactly they are, the alphas and the betas. So let's calculate the alphas and the betas. This is a very lengthy calculation. I'm giving you the main steps here, the ones that are difficult. The rest in between is quite easy. But you see, some is actually quite difficult, and one has to admire the tenacity of those who actually fought their way through this. Okay, so we make the ansatz here. We make this ansatz for the as yet unknown Bogoliubov coefficients and plug that into here, right, where we have the B's. So we can express all of this in terms of A's and A daggers. And then we collect terms. All the A terms have to match, all the A dagger terms have to match. So we do all of that. And then we obtain, when we collect the coefficients for A, we obtain this equation here, which relates, I mean, these are the coefficients in front of the A. So there's no A or A dagger in this anymore. This is just setting coefficients equal. So that's what you get from just substituting in there. And now we pick out a particular frequency of this by multiplying with the plane wave and integrating over. See, if you multiply with the plane wave and then integrate over, you pick out a Fourier coefficient. So we are studying that equation Fourier frequency by Fourier frequency. So we multiply that, we multiply this exponential here, and we multiply it there, and we integrate over the du bar. And we use the fact that when you have the integral over a plane wave, and that sort of thing occurs here because we have this plane wave multiplying that plane wave or that plane wave, right? And we have a u bar and a u bar here, so we have that kind of thing occurring. We have an orthogonality condition. Plane waves are orthogonal to each other with the continuum's normalization. So we use that, and then we obtain from this, we can obtain in the case of either choosing plus or minus, we can obtain an equation for the alpha or for the beta, depending on whether we chose the plus or the minus. So we obtain at this point an expression for the Bogoliubov alpha coefficients as this integral. And similarly for the Bogoliubov beta coefficients as that integral. What changes is the sign here in the exponent. So you might think, oh, we're done. We have expressed the Bogoliubov beta coefficients. Those are the interesting ones because they describe particle creation. We express those in terms of an integral. Oh, how hard can it be to solve an integral? But look at this integral. It's really a fancy one if you think about it, because you see, here we have an integral over u bar, and then have e to the power of I omega u and I capital omega u bar, where the u is a function of u bar, exponential. So what we have is a quite exquisite integrand here. We have an exponential of an exponential. See, the u is minus 1 over a e to the power of minus a u bar. So that's what goes into here. So it's useful, therefore, to change variables so that we don't integrate over the u bar, but that we integrate over the u. So from this equation, remember that was in the equation in the double box? We take that equation and differentiate it for the purpose of changing variables from that integration variable to the du. So du by du bar is just that exponential. And from that, we get that we can express that using this again in terms of the a and the u. See, just multiply that over here. And then we obtain that du bar is 1 over minus au du. That's what we can put into here. So now we can rewrite our solution here, our Bogoliubov coefficients, in this form. This is what we had here. But now we can write it like that. We have an exponential here, and then we have a power. So we have e to the exponential of u, and then we have u to the power of something. This is like a power, like a monomial, times an exponential. And then we integrate that over. You see, that thing we know how to do, because that's a definition of the gamma function. Exponential times a monomial. So therefore, that integral can be expressed using the gamma function in this way. So we have now explicitly, in terms of the gamma function, both the Bogoliubov alpha and the Bogoliubov beta coefficient. And who thinks of this, that you can do this, you just need the gamma function? OK. But if you remember, in lecture 8, at some point, we also had the gamma function come up. It was a very similar calculation, even though it was a very different approach to getting there. But at some point, yeah, it all converged to that kind of integral. OK, and now we can compare the alpha and the beta coefficients. We find that they only differ by that factor here. Other than that, they are the same, right? The only difference is here a plus or a minus. And that means that we can write the beta squared as this factor squared, because it's a plus or a minus, times the alpha factor. But the alpha and the beta are related also here in the Wronskian condition. And that we can use in order to express the alphas in terms of the betas. And then we obtain an equation for the beta. So how many particles then do we see? How many particles does an accelerated observer see? So if you are traveling along with the uniformly accelerated observer, you share their coordinate system. You quantize the way that this accelerated observer quantizes. And the state of the system, the quantum field, is supposed to be the vacuum state as determined by an inertial observer. So the universe is really empty here, but observers may be uniformly accelerated. Then we can ask, will they see particles? And if so, what's the expectation value of the number of particles for any given momentum? So for that purpose, we take the number operator for a particular momentum or energy. It's the same thing in 1 plus 1d, of the accelerated observer. And the state is the in state as determined, as we discussed earlier. That should be the vacuum as determined by the inertial observer. But it's the accelerated observer that counts particles now. So it's the Minkowski vacuum, left and right. But the number operator is of the accelerated kind. So it's expressed as a b dagger b. But the b dagger b we can write in terms of the a dagger a's in this way. And now, at this point, we can use this Wronskian condition here to get rid of the Bogoliubov alpha coefficients, and we just get an expression in terms of the Bogoliubov beta coefficients here. And then what we find is that, and here are the Bogoliubov beta coefficients, and what we find is that the number operator's expectation value in the Minkowski vacuum is given by the integral over these beta coefficients, which can be carried out, and we obtain that expression here. Which is divergent, because we have a Dirac delta of omega minus omega, so that's the Dirac delta of zero. But that's just because we haven't imposed an infrared cutoff. If there's any, remember, if there's any particle creation, any particle density, and we have an infinite volume, then we have infinitely many particles. So what we ought to do is put the whole thing into a box. And the box could be much, much larger than the time period, than what the particle crosses in the time period that we might be interested in. So if we do that, then this will no longer be a Dirac delta. It will be a Kronecker delta. And these omegas will be discrete values, because the momentum values will be discretized in a box. And then what we obtain is that the number expectation value is given by this prefactor here, where, remember, this A is the constant of acceleration. This is not the annihilation operator here. This is the constant of acceleration here. That came in, just in case you wonder, it came in here. This A and that A is the acceleration. It's not the not any annihilation operator. Right, so that's what we obtain. And as the volume grows, this number grows, but we can calculate what the number density is. So we divide this by the volume, get rid of the V factor. So the number density of particles with momentum or energy omega, right moving ones, is given by 1 over this value. I don't know if you recognize this behavior, but it's the behavior of a harmonic oscillator's number expectation value as a function of the temperature. If you take a harmonic oscillator with energy spectrum omega times n plus 1 half and expose it to a heat bath of temperature T, then the expected number of excitations that you have in that harmonic oscillator, so the expected excitation level of the harmonic oscillator, is given by 1 over e to the power of the natural frequency, this is h bar omega, natural frequency of the oscillator divided by t. It would really be a kt if we cared about the Boltzmann constant. And the higher the temperature, the closer, the larger the t is, therefore the smaller that exponent is, therefore the closer this is to zero, therefore the e to the power close to zero is close to one, therefore the denominator is the smaller, and therefore the whole thing is the larger. So the larger the temperature is, the larger the expectation value of the excitation of the harmonic oscillator. And if you compare that now, you see that it has the same overall behavior as this, the number expectation value. So the mode with frequency or energy omega of the accelerated observer, that mode, remember, is a harmonic oscillator. And its expectation value of its number expectation value is a formula that's very similar to that as if it were exposed to a thermal bath. And it's exactly the same formula if you identify the temperature with A divided by 2 pi. Because A divided by 2 pi, that would be just like a 1 over T. Then you have omega divided by T. So this means that an accelerated observer perceives the Minkowski space vacuum such that all of the accelerated observer's mode oscillators are in an are excited generally, and the number expectation value for these excitations matches the number expectation value that the same modes would have if exposed to a thermal bath. And that's quite non-trivial, because it could be that some modes are excited as if exposed to a temperature of to a bath of this temperature, and other modes would be excited as if exposed to a bath of another temperature. But what we see here is that all of the modes behave as if exposed to a temperature, as if exposed to a thermal bath of the same temperature, which is acceleration divided by 2 pi. So the acceleration acts directly as if it was a temperature. Now, something that looks like an afterthought, but it's going to be super important for Hawking radiation. Let's ask whether the quantum field could be arranged to be in what the accelerated observer perceives as the vacuum state. We would expect that there's some sort of symmetry here. Yeah, the accelerated observer might arrange the quantum field to be in what the accelerated observer considers to be the no particle state. And then we would expect that an inertial observer would say, oh, this is no longer the vacuum now. This is an excited state with lots of particles. Not so fast. Actually, there is no such thing as the vacuum state of the uniformly accelerated observer. And the reason is that it's energetically forbidden. As we will see in a moment, that state which the uniformly accelerated observers would consider to be the no particle state would have regions of infinite energy density. And that can't quite be right. So let's see how this comes about. Remember the energy momentum tensor. The energy momentum tensor is kinetic terms minus kinetic terms. So what we have to study here, if we want to know about the energy density, is what are the expectation values of kinetic terms in the Rindler vacuum. So the so-called Rindler vacuum is the vacuum state as defined by uniformly accelerated observers. So then what we would calculate is, in the Rindler vacuum state, for example, what that term is, the du phi squared. That's one of the terms that would come up in the calculation of the energy momentum tensor. Well, that's the vacuum expectation value of the du bar squared term. I mean, this is, I'm just translating here from the u variable to the u bar variable. And remember what we are doing here. We are taking the energy momentum tensor, and I'm writing it down in the usual Cartesian coordinates, but we're calculating the expectation value for the Rindler vacuum. And here we change it to Lightcon coordinates, but still for the inertial observer's Lightcon coordinates. And now here, we rewrite that in terms of the accelerated observer's Lightcon coordinates. And remember again that crucial equation here in the double box, which relates the u to the u bar. From there, we know that du by du bar is minus a u. That gives us this factor here. So what we obtain is that the that energy density here is given by that kinetic term in the coordinates of the accelerated observers in the Rindler vacuum, and then we have this prefactor here. And notice that that's a somewhat suspicious prefactor, because the u can go to zero on the light cone, and then that would blow up. So here's the thing. We said that the accelerated observer defines the vacuum state, in fact, quantizes the theory in exactly the same way that somebody who is inertial would do, because, at least in the massless case, they are facing the exact same equations. It's the same action. It's the same equations of motion. Why would you solve them differently? But that means that the value for that is the same as the value here, because they're calculated the same way. And that means that the relationship between, this is the energy density that you get in Minkowski space as an inertial observer, but if you choose not the Minkowski vacuum, but the Rindler vacuum, you get this extra prefactor here, which blows up at the light cone. So that state, yes, it has tons of particles from the perspective of the Minkowski inertial observers, but more important than that, the energy density blows up towards the horizon. So U inverse goes to infinity at the traveler's horizon. But that would mean that the energy momentum tensor's expectation value in the Rindler vacuum diverges towards the light cone, towards the horizons of that observer. And it's true not just for U going to zero, but also for V going to zero. Now you might say, okay, but don't we normalize the energy density of the vacuum to be zero? Well, you could renormalize that, but if you have a few particles, you have a bit of energy, and then that would again, they contribute to the energy momentum tensor, and the particles can never be completely localized. They would have tails towards the horizon, and there that would blow up.
Is this related to the fact that you don't have a bijection between the coordinates there on the board?
Ultimately, yes. Yes, you can view it this way. It's because an entire world is squeezed into just a quadrant. And what is for the accelerated observer, a universe that extends arbitrarily far in all directions. You see, the psi tilde 0 and the psi tilde 1, the Cartesian coordinates of the accelerated observer run from minus infinity to plus infinity. So the accelerated observer has a coordinate system that's also R2. There are no boundaries. And for that observer, the energy density in the vacuum, whatever it is constant. But that entire R2 is squeezed into a quadrant in Minkowski space. And so what is constant in the accelerated coordinate system, a constant energy density, becomes the energy density that, since all of it is squeezed into the quadrant, at the quadrant boundaries, where it's really squeezed together, that's where the energy density then diverges.
What if you consider a restriction such that there's a bijection on particular regions? Does that resolve it?
So what would you do then? You could, for example, restrict your. You could the accelerated observer could say, I put boundaries, so I'm not considering all of R2. I'm considering a subspace of that. In this way, you would avoid that divergence, but you would also not fill the quadrant, right? You would not fill that, and then you would have to explain what is the physics of not filling that. You would have to put some boundaries, some physical boundaries actually there, because your waves would propagate. The waves, if you don't put mirrors or anything there or walls, then the waves would propagate in R2. Just remember, for the accelerated observer, it's just an R2. So 1 plus 1 d. Quantum field theory with the usual equations of motion and the usual solutions. Okay, so we're almost done. So the picture is then, that's just showing where this happens. We squeeze all of R2 of the accelerated observer into just that Rindler quadrant here. And of course, that's. That means that the energy momentum, that the energy density is blowing up as you approach these horizons there. So that state should physically not be possible to build. So let's keep that in mind for Thursday, because there we will map the mass of the Unruh effect to the mass of the Hawking effect, and that question here will come up again, namely, which vacuum could our system possibly be in? And what we saw here is that the Minkowski space vacuum is perfectly fine. It is a state that is physical. The inertial observers would agree that there are no particles. The accelerated observers would say, yes, there are particles. In fact, every mode has excitations as if exposed to a thermal bath. But nothing is divergent here. On the other hand, the other takeaway message here is that the Rindler vacuum is not a physical state here, because it leads to these infinite energy densities towards these divergent energy densities towards the horizon. And for one thing, it's not just that it's divergent and therefore probably not physical. It's also that the energy density grows to large values. Even before it's infinite, our assumptions break. We made the assumption that we are dealing here with Minkowski space. And if anywhere there is a significantly large energy density, then it's no longer Minkowski space. Then our assumptions don't work anymore. Then we would have to take into account the back reaction of it. So this point that we saw today, namely that the Rindler vacuum in principle can be defined, however, it has the property that it leads to divergent energy density towards the horizon. That property, the mass of that, and in part the physics of it, will be important on Thursday when we study Hawking radiation. Because there, we will also have to ask, well, what kind of observers can we have? Well, we can have observers that are, let's say, close to the black hole, and others that might be far away from the black hole. We might have observers that are freely falling. Others might be screwed in place, might be held fixed. And how would each of them define the vacuum state? And then which is the state that the system is in? Before black hole forms, what state could the system be in after the black hole forms? What is the reasonable state? And then if we find that a candidate state has the property that the energy density, the vacuum energy density, would be divergent towards the horizon, in this case of a black hole, then we could say, well, it's either not physical because it's divergent, or it violates our assumptions because that should gravitate and then change the solution that we assumed at the beginning. So let's just take this away with us here. I mean, apart from the math, like, we will have an equation very similar to this one.